Our cities are burning and police officers are being ambushed. None of this is spontaneous. Today, our guests will discuss with us how and why communists and Marxists precipitate mob violence. You're watching Anarchy in America with Christian Gomez. And joining us to discuss how communists precipitate mob violence is Art Thompson, former CEO of the John Birch Society from 2005 to 2020. Art, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So let's get right into it. Now, before you were the CEO of the John Birch Society in 2005 when you became CEO, long before that, you were a coordinator for the John Birch Society.
True.
In the state of Washington.
No, I was very active in leadership in the state of Washington.
Chapter leader?
Section leader. Any number of other different things as well. Support your local police committee, chairman in Seattle, that kind of thing.
And you were the head of the Support Local Police Committee during the time of the Civil Rights Movement, right, in the 60s and 70s in Seattle?
That's correct. I was executive secretary, yes.
So from your experience at the time, what sort of tactics of violence, mob violence, did you see or experience from the communists and other Marxist-orientated groups and people at the time?
Well, they did any number of things. They actually had two basic tactics they used. One was to intimidate people, to agitate them into violence. In other words, they could stand back after what they had done, and the white folk or whatever would attack them, the police would attack them for doing things that were illegal, belligerent, that sort of thing. They themselves never got involved in violence. The Martin Luther Kings, the John Lewis's, they never got involved in violence, but they provoked violence on the other side to create that image of we're just peaceful folks. And then they could point the finger at these terrible, whatever they happened to be, just angry people in the neighborhood that got sick and tired of what was going on or down at the courthouse, that kind of thing. On the other hand, you had the militant groups, the Black Panthers and those sorts, who actually did promote violence. They would start fires, for instance, and they would have snipers at these fires for the first responders that when they would come, usually the firemen, they would start shooting at them. Then the police would come, and usually they would withdraw very quickly. But they would get this violence started. That's what happened in Watts. They burnt down a lot of the Watts district in L.A. But they did this in city after city after city across the country.
How is that the same or different from what's going on today with BLM and the riots and revolutions we're seeing in the streets of America?
Well, you don't have the Martin Luther Kings and John Lewis's today that are out front trying to intimidate mob action by their opponents. In other words, the people in the neighborhood, that sort of thing, or the businessmen. What you have is strictly the violent aspect coming from the Marxists, the Black Lives Matter people, the Antifa and those, to where that is exclusively the tactic they're using now to create all sorts of chaos.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned John Lewis, late Congressman John Lewis. Now, before he was elected to the House back in 1988, many people may not recall, but you probably do recall, that he was the national chairman for something called the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And according to the state of Louisiana's Joint Legislative Committee on Un-American Activities, they found that for an 80-month period, that group received over $10,000 from the Southern Conference Education Fund, which was a known communist front. So was John Lewis a communist or connected, let's say, if not a card-carrying member, but connected to communists, specifically in the Seattle area where you were active in?
I used to infiltrate Marxist organizations in the day, and I was at a meeting with John Lewis and met him. And he was the only guy that was in the leadership in that room that I could not prove was a communist.
This was a Communist Party conference you were attending?
Well,
undercover?
It was a communist front.
Okay.
And there have been some facts that he was a member of the Young Communist League at the time, which was called the W.E.B. Du Bois Clubs. Mm-hmm. They changed the name of the Young Communist League to the W.E.B. Du Bois Clubs after a black individual, to try and give it a facade, if you will, of being involved in the civil rights movement, when in fact they were the youth arm of the Communist Party. So Yeah, he was one of these types, as I mentioned earlier, that would provoke people into violence on the other side. They would do crazy things. Some of the things it's very difficult to put in a video because they were so bad. I mean, purient kinds of things. For instance, they would rent costumes of being a Catholic priest and a Catholic nun, and then do
fornicating activities.
Sexual acts on the courthouse steps and things like that. Then they would be carted off in handcuffs. And as far as the media was concerned, those were Catholic priests and nuns. They weren't. They would go into a restaurant, and they would urinate into the sugar bowl on the tables and that kind of thing. And then they would be arrested. And the media would promote it as being, well, all these people wanted to do was to eat, you know, in a non-segregated restaurant. And they got arrested for that. No, they got arrested for doing what they did.
The lewd activity.
Yeah. So this was not unusual, but the media, just like today, would not report the real facts as to what was going on. But John Lewis was very active in a lot of that.
Now, I got a longer question here for you. I was doing some research before we started our interview. So Lewis, he held some quasi-insurrectionist views, just to put it mildly. For example, in justifying the use of violence, according to an article that appeared in the December 7, 1963 issue of the San Francisco Chronicle, they said that he felt the possibility of violence is justified because out of this conflict, this division and chaos will come something positive, end quote. And that's also reminiscent of Rahm Emanuel saying that we shouldn't let a crisis go to waste. And all this is consistent with sort of with Karl Marx's beliefs about using violence, which begs the question, why do Marxists and these communist individuals, why do they use violence? What do they hope to achieve by violence that they don't think they can get unless they use violence?
Well, a couple of things. Number one is intimidation, to silence the majority of the people who want security. Please, mob, pass by my house and leave me alone. Kind of a thing. We saw that in St. Louis, for instance, with that McCluskey couple that defended their home. He had AR-15, and she had an inoperative pistol, by the way. And the neighbors got mad at them because they felt that if they just let the mob go by, they'll leave us alone. Don't antagonize them. They might burn down our house instead of yours. Sort of thing. So it's a certain amount of intimidation that goes on there. But at any rate, the main thing, and this is what the communist rabble, not the leadership, but the rabble does not understand, and that is that the violence that they're promoting is to create more government, more controls, not local controls, but national controls, federal controls, because the local police obviously can't take care of the problem, right? So we're going to have to call in the national government.
And we've seen that place like Seattle, Minneapolis, where the federal government, Justice Department, has already been overseeing the police departments long before these incidents have occurred, recent incidents.
That's true, but what they want is a completely nationalized police force on the road to an international police force under the banner of the United Nations. Now, the average person who's involved in the streets does not understand that strategy. They don't understand quite what they're doing.
Why would communists want to empower potential Republican presidents having a national police force? What's the idea behind that then?
Well, the thing is that there's another thing going on at the same time, and that is that they're trying to convince the average conservative, law-abiding citizen to support federalization of the police in the name of the violence. They don't care who's president at any given moment because they think that they'll be able to get their people into Congress and into the White House at some point in the future to use that control. That control may be very benign at first as a result of it being under a Republican administration, for instance, under a Donald Trump or whomever. But down the road, with incremental steps, that control will become greater and greater and greater until finally, once they get control, then they will be able to come and get people like you and me away from the microphone.
Yes.
So we won't be able to explain what's going on. We won't be able to educate the American people as to how they can prevent this draconian government from growing. You know, local police is the only thing, you know, the United States is the only country that has local police, completely local. Some have a hybrid of federal and or national and local, but most have national police. Beholding to the national government, not to the local citizens, not to the local city council and mayor and that guy that stands in line and votes down at the local precinct.
So then it's important for people to realize that when communists and Marxists and leftists in general are saying abolish the police and defund the police, that they're specifically targeting local police, but not necessarily let's abolish national police.
Well, you know it's going to leave a
vacuum. National law enforcement.
Abolishing the police or downgrading the police is going to leave a vacuum, right?
And who fills the vacuum?
Who fills the vacuum? And they know that. I mean, maybe not the dummies that are cheering in front of the megaphone, but the people with the megaphone, they understand what they're doing. And they want to create a vacuum into which a national government or a national police, that they come in and fill that vacuum.
So in addition to Lewis's student nonviolent coordinating committee, there was also back in the day.
We used to call it SNCC, by the
yeah,
way.
Yeah, SNCC.
SNCC.
Yes. Before there was also the Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, which has been brought back actually as the new SDS under the Maoist Freedom Road Socialist Organization. And then, of course, Vladimir Lenin, he wrote a whole book about youth and the importance of youth. Why is it that the communists and Marxists in general always seem to target and go after young people, the youth specifically?
Well, frankly, and I hope that the youth watching this won't get mad at me, but basically you're filling an empty brain with information that they can put in there, but they can't do it very well to a person who's got some experience in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. You can't change their minds very well. You can't get them to believe the lies that you tell them. But the youth who are going to school to learn things, they don't know a lot of things. In that those cases, they fill their heads with all of this Marxist baloney.
Like the 1619 Project promoted by the New York Times.
As an example. And what a lot of people don't know is that indentured slaves in this country were mainly Englishmen, and they were here before black slavery was here. Mm-hmm. That white slavery was already here before black slavery was introduced to America, North America.
Of course, in the public schools, they try to make the distinction of indentured servants versus slaves. They sort of soften the experience that the indentured servants went through. Well, it wasn't quite slavery as bad as what it was under the African Americans and so forth.
Well, it's partially true.
Mm-hmm.
Because your indentured slaves or people might be for 7 years, for instance, and it might have been voluntary to pay their way to the new world. I want to go to the new world where I have better opportunity and everything else, but I don't have the money to get there. So you go to a ship owner or whatever, and you say, "I'll put myself in an indentured status, and you can sell me when you drop me off in America and get your money." Now that's the low end of indentured. Mm-hmm. The high end of indentured was if you were guilty of treason. Instead of killing you, they put you into a permanent indentured status. You might get out of it, but it was more likely you'd be dead before you got to that point.
Much like the history of Australia being a penal
colony,
Botany Bay.
Sure, so you had everything in between. But it was a system of slavery for either a specific length of time or for a person's life. Back taxes, all sorts of different
and many
things.
Of those 7 year terms of being a servant in the United States, a lot of times they extended those terms or had them sign contracts that they couldn't read, because it wasn't just African Americans who perhaps couldn't read well, but also many of these poor Englishmen and poor Irishmen who came to the United States also had the same.
Sure.
They suffered the same exact conditions as well. So what role do these youth groups and student groups play right now in BLM, in your observation of what's going on?
Well, basically, they form the backbone of the people in the streets. They're not the young ones in high school particularly, but in the college age and just shortly beyond that, they've been indoctrinated for so many years that they form the cadre, if you will, of these street mobs. Now, some of them are going from city to city. They're obviously being supported, financed by someone to travel around from city to city to perform these acts, but you've got to have a core in those cities in order to be able to for these people to come in and flesh it out and give them direction and perpetuate whatever demonstrations that are going to be put together into violence.
So for the average person watching out there, regardless of their age, young or more experienced, what would you recommend that they do to sort of expose and combat this besides bringing their own sugar to a restaurant, let's say?
Well, the thing is that it all boils down to education. You've got to inform yourself and then inform others as to what's going on, what's behind everything. And once the people understand what's going on, they'll apply pressure to their local authorities better than what they're doing now. It's almost non-existent in some of these cities. And so even the most liberal Democrat doesn't want his house burnt down, right?
Yes.
And so they will do what it takes to get their local people to do what's right if they know the extent of the problem, what's behind the problem, and the remedy of it. It goes beyond that, though, in the long term, because you've got to get to the schools. Either get to the schools or get your kids out of the schools. Look, back in the 60s, I used to be asked a lot to get into schools to speak to classes or assemblies, what have you. And the things I saw there, even today, are almost unbelievable.
In the public schools, you
mean?
In
the public schools. And this was in Seattle. But, for instance, I was brought in to talk to a small group of kids in one school in Seattle. And the room we were in was the day room or study hall or whatever they called it. It was a Marxist headquarters. They had pictures of all the leftists and Marxists up around the top of the wall next to the ceiling, and a table with the Students for a Democratic Society literature. And that was it. It was a Marxist study hall.
So the SDS can have their literature in the school, but groups like the Gideons, they have to be a block or two away if they want to pass out New Testaments.
Exactly. And I would go into a classroom, for instance, where you would have a picture of Mao Zedong and Ho Chi Minh and the flag of North Vietnam, and they were teaching the kids to be on the side of the enemy during the Vietnam War.
Wow.
And these things were not unusual. There was one assembly that I addressed in a very prestigious college there, high school rather, where we had close to 2,000 kids, and I almost turned it into a riot because I was the only guy versus seven other people from the ACLU, from SDS, from Benzo Ramos Brigade, the Young People's Socialist Alliance, you name it, they were there, and then me. And so what I did was I showed the similarity between the Hitler Youth and the young communist youth at that time in the streets. And it just created, the kids, for instance, the students were up to here with their teachers teaching them communism, and they didn't like it. And so it they got all stirred up over it, and when it was all over, all the leftist organizers came up and surrounded me. Here I am standing in the middle of about 10 deep people in 360 degrees around me, because they did not want me to go around to the classrooms to talk to the classes, which I was supposed to have done.
Yes.
But at any rate, this is back in the 60s. That's the kind of thing that was going on then.
Wow.
You can well imagine what's going on today. It's far worse.
Thank you so much, Art Thompson. We're out of time today, but we appreciate having you on.
My pleasure.
Precipitating mob violence is perhaps the most well-known of the communist steps for takeover that we currently see playing out in our nation's cities and streets, and which is only likely to intensify after the election. Next week, we'll discuss the fifth step, creating semblance of revolution. Until then, God bless.